You are listening to the Talking Information Center. It is Wednesday, the 19th of August, 2026, and we begin the reading of today's Boston Globe by saying hello to Karen and Pamela.
Good morning, this is Pamela.
And Karen.
And from the front page, Markey keeps lead over Moulton. Poll shows Senator consolidating edge despite some concerns about his age. With 2 weeks until the state's September 1 primary, U.S. Senator Ed Markey leads U.S. Representative Seth Moulton by double digits in their contentious Democratic Senate primary, a new Suffolk University Boston Globe poll found, underscoring the 80-year-old Markey's political resiliency and Moulton's challenge in persuading undecided voter to embrace his calls for new leadership. More than 52% of 500 likely primary voters said they would choose or lean toward backing Markey if the election were held today, compared with roughly 38% who said they would pick Moulton. The 47-year-old Iraq War veteran has made Markey's age and seniority a central part of his challenge. That would leave Moulton trailing Markey by more than 14 percentage points, with about 9% of the likely Democratic voters surveyed saying they are still undecided. The share of undecided voters has dwindled from April, when a Suffolk Globe poll showed 20% undecided, with Markey enjoying a similar margin over Moulton. The results suggest Moulton faces a steep climb in the final days of the primary. A UMass Amherst poll released on Monday also found the incumbent senator leading Moulton by as many as 28 percentage points and topping among several groups of voters, including veterans, notable given Moulton's background as a Marine veteran. The Suffolk Globe poll found Markey is also leading an array of demographic groups who factor heavily into a Democratic primary, including women, registered Democrats, and voters who live in Suffolk County. Among women alone, Markey led by 27 percentage points, the poll found. Stephanie Dealey, a 70-year-old Democrat from Framingham who was among those surveyed, said that while Moulton brings a lot of good tools to the table, she said she doesn't believe in voting out someone who's done a good job without good reason, and I don't believe that age is a good reason. It would be wonderful if he was 20 years younger, she said of Markey, but I don't think that he's showing any signs that his age is impacting his ability to do the job. David Paleologos, director of the Suffolk University Political Research Center, said Suffolk's polling has never suggested the primary was close, and Tuesday's result point to a race that Markey has successfully locked up. Markey's strength is among the voters that count in a Democratic primary, Paleologos said. Markey still leads Moulton by 19 percentage points in a bellwether poll of Kelmser voters. That survey included 300 likely primary voters from the Merrimack Valley town, which Paleologos said correctly called the order of the top three presidential candidates in the 2020 Democratic primary, as in neither Moulton's current congressional district nor Markey's former one when he was a member of the House. The generational fight in Massachusetts is playing out as voters elsewhere have selected younger, more progressive candidates in safe blue districts across the country, from New York to Colorado. In this race, however, the candidate viewed as more progressive is Markey, not his younger challenger. Nearly 48% of those surveyed said they considered Markey as more progressive, while 22% said the same of Moulton. Several voters said that while they had concerns about Markey's age, they felt he better represents their values or had done a good enough job in office in his two-plus terms to deserve another. Markey has said he would not seek another term if reelected this year. Democratic primary voters also largely gave Markey good marks. About 67% said they viewed him favorably, compared with 42% who said the same of Moulton, a six-term congressman. Adam Tessier, a 39-year-old accountant from Draycott, who was part of the Suffolk Globe poll, said he is against geriatrics in Congress, but that he had other concerns about Moulton, including the accepted donations from pro-Israel interest groups in the past. Moulton said last fall he was returning donations he took from AIPAC, a pro-Israel group. "I'll vote for the old man," said Tessier, who is unenrolled but tends to vote with Democrats. Moulton's support appeared to rest with unenrolled voters, as well as self-identified moderate and conservative voters at the Suffolk Globe poll. But it's unclear if his primary argument that Markey is too old to serve another six-year term is enough. Nearly half of the 500 voters surveyed said all else being equal, Markey turning 80 in July made no difference in their choice. By comparison, 33% of voters said the senator's age would make them less likely to vote for him. Another 11% said they would not vote for him because of his age. "We need new blood," said Barbara Tadeo, a six-year-old Democrat from Chicopee who plans to vote for Moulton. Tadeo said she believes the Democratic response to the Trump administration has been horrible. They're wimps. Moulton, she said, will at least have more of a backbone, rather than just bending to everything that's been happening. Markey, meanwhile, held a lead among young people aged 18 to 35, winning support from 58% of them in the Suffolk Globe survey, compared with Moulton's 35%. Younger supporters helped bolster Markey's successful 2020 re-election bid when he fended off another younger challenger in then-Representative Joseph Kennedy III. Natanya Perlis, a 29-year-old graduate student in Boston, said that, like many progressive voters in Massachusetts, she was more interested in down-ballot races for the state legislature and Congress. But she is planning to support Markey, saying, "The most important to me is his unwavering support for the trans community." Moulton drew significant backlash when he invoked young trans athletes after Democrats' 2024 election losses in a New York Times interview, saying he would not want his two young daughters getting run over in a playing field by a male or formerly male athlete. Moulton has since apologized for those comments, but Perlis said she believes Moulton is more likely to sell at marginalized communities that are being positioned as wedge issues by the Republicans. Looking beyond the 2026 midterms, Democratic primary voters said they are most excited by Pete Buttigieg among a list of potential 2028 presidential candidates, with 21% opting for the former mayor of South Bend, Indiana, and a 2020 presidential hopeful. About 14% felt most excited about New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, while 12% favored California Governor Gavin Newsom. The Suffolk Globe poll was conducted over 4 days from Thursday to Sunday, and its margin of error was plus or minus 4.4 percentage points. Live callers reached respondents via mobile and landlines. The bellwether poll of Chelmsford's residents was conducted over 4 days last week and had a margin of error of plus or minus 5.7 percentage points. Karen?
Thanks, Pamela. And also from today's front page, concerned local officials pull plugs on crypto kiosks. As scams proliferate, state also considers ban. Amid a rise in scams, 20 communities have banned cryptocurrency kiosks, with more considering following suit, as Massachusetts legislators continue to debate a statewide prohibition. Hundreds of crypto kiosks have popped up in convenience stores and gas stations across the Commonwealth in recent years, allowing customers to convert cash into Bitcoin in minutes. The machines have become a favorite tool of scammers, who use them to collect cash from victims. One local victim was undergoing cancer treatment in July 2024 when she was scammed by depositing $5,500 into a kiosk in Haverhill, most of it given to her by her prayer group. It was nearly everything she had in savings. Unlike regular bank ATMs, crypto kiosks in Massachusetts are largely unregulated by state banking authorities, despite allowing users to send tens of thousands of dollars in cash to anonymous online accounts. Well, that leaves few opportunities for scam victims to get their money back. Local officials pushing bans say efforts at the municipal level are stopgaps on a statewide problem, since scammers can simply direct victims to a nearby town that hasn't passed one. "Why wait for another victim to come along before we do the right thing?" said Beverly City Councilor Keith Sonia, who was pushed for a ban in his community. At least 35 states have enacted laws regulating the machines, and 5 have banned them outright, according to a tally by AARP, which has championed bans across the country. Every New England state except Massachusetts has regulated them, and Vermont implemented an outright ban last month. The political momentum behind a ban in Massachusetts has grown in recent weeks. Within Massachusetts, municipal bans now include Ipswich and Gloucester on the North Shore, Revere outside Boston, to Westfield and Longmeadow in the western part of the state. All 14 county sheriffs recently signed a letter urging state senators to pass a ban, and the Massachusetts District Attorneys Association voted unanimously in support. The renewed interest also follows a Globe investigation published last month, which traced roughly $500,000 in losses to just 7 machines in Haverhill. The state Senate voted to ban the machines statewide as an amendment to a broader economic development bill. But a House version of the bill did not include the measure, so a conference committee of six state lawmakers negotiating the final version of the legislation will decide if the ban actually becomes law. Two of the three senators on the chamber's negotiating team say they support it. Scammers are using cryptocurrency ATMs to target our most vulnerable community members and draining them of their hard-earned savings, said Senator Barry Feingold, an Andover Democrat and the Senate chair of the Committee on Economic Development and Emerging Technologies. Senator Peter Durant, a Republican and self-described supporter of cryptocurrency, also said he would support a ban. Senator Michael Rodriguez, the chamber's budget chief and the other Democrat on the Senate's three-member panel, did not respond to requests for comment. But none of the three House members on the committee would say where they stand. Representative Michael Soder, a Republican, declined to comment. Democratic Representatives Carol Fiola and Aaron Mikulewicz, the House budget chair, did not respond to requests for comment. The House has been here before. A narrower bill last year that would cap the amount of money a person can deposit each day and would require some victims to be refunded their money did not advance. Kiosk owners have argued that regulations short of a ban could address the problem, like requiring refunds for fraud victims. A strict ban, they said, carries its own cost. Banning crypto kiosks won't stop fraud. Instead, it pushes scammers toward channels with fewer safeguards, said a spokesperson for CoinFlip, one of the largest kiosk operators still in business. But Sonia, the Beverly counselor, called the machines a scam factory and said that he doesn't hear about too many legitimate customers using them. They are a great tool if you are a scammer, he said. Beverly has had multiple cases of crypto ATM fraud. One 70-year-old local woman lost $120,000 at crypto kiosks over 4 years by driving across the bridge to Salem to make the deposit, Sonia said. He expects a ban to come up for a vote this fall, assuming the state doesn't act first. East Hampton is also moving to ban the machines, according to Councillor Felicia Jadczak, who filed an ordinance in late May. She is hoping that by passing a ban locally, other nearby towns may feel compelled to act. My hope would be that if something like this would pass, then the surrounding cities and towns would follow our lead, she said. Local officials have their own doubts about how much a town-by-town approach can accomplish. Michaela Spagone, a town councillor in Bridgewater, said the key to solving the issue is state regulation. This is not just a local issue, she told the Globe. It is a statewide issue which garners the need for statewide protection. Bridgewater is not currently considering a ban, Spagone said, though she is open to the idea. Pamela?
Thanks, Karen. And from the front page as well, testimony pivots to Clancy's claim of hearing voices. Psychologist talks of grim assessment after slayings. This story may contain content listeners find disturbing or triggering. Lindsay Clancy was handcuffed to a bed in the intensive care unit at Brigham Women's Hospital, with two state troopers standing guard outside her door when a psychologist showed up to evaluate whether she was competent to stand trial for killing her three children 11 days earlier. The psychologist, Paul Zeisel, testified at Clancy's murder trial Tuesday that he was the first visitor allowed to see her after the slayings in January 2023, and only after her lawyer obtained a court order. She immediately asked to call her husband, according to Zeisel, who handed her his cell phone. The call went unanswered, and Clancy left a message. 2 days later, Clancy tried again during Zeisel's second visit. This time, Clancy's then-husband, Patrick, picked up, and Zeisel said he listened on speaker as the couple spoke for the first time since she strangled the children in the basement of their Duxbury home. She told Patrick that she loved him very much, Zeisel told jurors. She said that she heard a male voice ordering her, telling her that she didn't have any choice, but that she had to kill her children and then kill herself. Zeisel was among four witnesses called to the stand by the defense Tuesday in Plymouth Superior Court, in an effort to convince jurors that she was suffering from postpartum psychosis when she strangled her children and should not be held criminally responsible. The account by Zeisel of Clancy's call to Patrick corroborates testimony he gave when called as a prosecution witness at the start of the trial 4 weeks ago. They are the only two witnesses out of 79 who have testified so far who told jurors Lindsay Clancy claimed she was hearing voices at the time of the slayings. A state trooper testified earlier in the trial that the lead investigator on the case had floated a theory that Zeisel told Clancy to lie about hearing voices. But the trooper admitted during cross-examination police found no evidence to support that theory. On Tuesday, Clancy's attorney, Kevin Reddington, asked Zeisel if he told Clancy to pretend she heard voices telling her to kill her children. Absolutely not, Zeisel said. When pressed about why he let Clancy use his phone, Zeisel said, I let her call her husband out of human compassion. Clancy, 36, has admitted she strangled 5-year-old Cora, 3-year-old Dawson, and 8-month-old Callan with an exercise band in the basement of their Duxbury home on January 24th, 2023. She then slashed her neck and wrists and jumped out of a second-story window in a failed suicide attempt. She was paralyzed from the waist down and appears in court each day in a wheelchair. Clancy has pleaded not guilty to 3 counts of first-degree murder, asserting that she should not be held criminally responsible because she was in the throes of postpartum psychosis and heard a male voice in her head telling her to kill herself and the children. Prosecutors contend that the slayings were premeditated and that Clancy wanted to kill herself because she was tired of her life and decided to take the children with her because she didn't trust anyone else to care for them as she did. On Tuesday, the second day the defense began presenting evidence, the focus was on Clancy's mental health as 4 witnesses testified about she struggled to get help for postpartum anxiety and depression, beginning in the fall of 2022, and revealed that she was having suicidal thoughts. Zeisel told jurors he reviewed all of her medical records and met with her about 60 times. He described Clancy's steady decline and worsening symptoms as doctors and nurse practitioners prescribed numerous medications for her to treat postpartum anxiety, depression, and insomnia between September 2022 and January 2023. The medications were making things worse. They were not helping her, he said. Clancy went to the emergency room twice and called a suicide hotline twice around the holidays in late 2022. She was worried about killing herself, said Zeisel, adding that she was turned away. Zeisel told jurors Clancy had symptoms consistent with psychosis, including auditory hallucinations, the voice telling her to kill her children. Clancy reported to doctors that she had horrible thoughts, said Zeisel, adding that she believed her thoughts were so loud that strangers could hear them. Zeisel said people with psychosis may have intermittent symptoms where they function one day and next day they're hearing voices. They're like waves at a beach, Zeisel said. They come and they go. Prosecutors have alleged Clancy was depressed and intended to kill herself, but was unable to go through with it. They have repeatedly focused on non-life-threatening wounds to Clancy's wrists and neck. In earlier testimony Tuesday, a psychiatrist and forensic pathologist testified that Clancy's medical records show that he reported suicidal ideation numerous times and that her injuries were a classic finding in suicide attempts. Dr. Donald Condi, a child, adolescent, and adult psychiatrist who did not treat Clancy but reviewed her medical records at the request of her attorney, said she made 2 separate calls to the Aspire Crisis Hotline in the month before the slayings. She also checked into McLean Hospital for inpatient psychiatric treatment for 5 days. Condi testified that a diagnosis of bipolar disorder for Clancy is a very serious possibility that has to be considered, and that Clancy's suicide ideation was reported very, very frequently in her medical records. Condi acknowledged that Clancy never told healthcare providers she was hearing voices until after the killings, but that records indicated she was scared her children would be taken away by the state if her symptoms were severe. Pressed by the prosecution, Condi acknowledged he was only speculating why Clancy may have withheld symptoms of psychosis from her providers. Reddington asked Condi whether the reasons a woman could minimize her symptoms to the providers out of fear. In the records, Ms. Clancy reports she was worried that her children would be taken away from her, perhaps by the Department of Children and Families, if she had a very severe symptoms, Condi said. Assistant District Attorney Shannon Buckingham asked, for a person who's begging for help, would it be important to be focused with the providers of what you're feeling, seeing, and hearing? It should be, Condi answered, but that's not always what doctors find. Dr. Elizabeth La Posada, a forensic pathologist who appeared in court by Zoom, told jurors that Clancy's injuries included so-called hesitation marks, which she said were a classic finding in suicide attempts. Those injuries caused significant bloodshed, she added. After Clancy jumped out of her window, she suffered a spinal injury that Poposada said was consistent with a head-first landing. Prosecutors, who have suggested Clancy was hesitant about killing herself and clung to the windowsill before falling, pressed La Posada on the lack of visible injuries to Clancy's head observed immediately after her fall. La Posada's the trauma from the impact was transferred to Clancy's vertebrae. Earlier Tuesday, Clancy's former mother-in-law, Susan Clancy, testified that she knew Clancy was begging for help for postpartum mental illness issues in late 2022, and the family was very concerned as she sought out numerous doctors. A tense moment came during the cross-examination of Susan Clancy by Buckingham. The prosecutor questioned her about attending Mass with her family, including Lindsay, on Christmas Day. Buckingham then suddenly asked Susan Clancy about her family's Catholic faith. "Are you an active member of the Catholic Church?" Buckingham asked. "Yes," Susan Clancy said. Buckingham then asked, "Are you aware that murder is considered a mortal sin?" That question drew a sharp response from Judge William F. Sullivan, who immediately called a sidebar before Susan Clancy could answer. After the brief huddle with the lawyers, Sullivan ordered the question stricken from the record and told jurors not to consider it. Karen?
Thanks, Pamela. Justice Department punished colleges despite lack of evidence, lawyer says. And this is from the Associated Press. A Trump administration task force created to combat anti-Semitism pushed for settlements with Ivy League universities despite government investigations that were rushed and incomplete or that failed to establish legal violations by the schools, a former Justice Department lawyer alleged in a whistleblower disclosure obtained by the Associated Press. The complaint alleges that the investigations into some of the nation's most prestigious academic institutions were designed to strong-arm the schools into cutting deals for political purposes. Outcomes of the investigations were predetermined without regard to the evidence, and a politically mandated effort to extract money from schools through settlement demands and funding freezes under the pretext of rooting out anti-Semitism, the complaint alleges. The work of the multi-agency task force launched by the Justice Department under then-Attorney General Pam Bondi in February 2025, was marked by extraordinary procedural irregularities, predetermined outcomes without factual or legal support, and disregard for the law and Constitution, lawyers for the former government attorney wrote in seeking watchdog investigations into their clients' complaints. The complaint taps into a broader public discussion about the administration's efforts to confront allegations of anti-Semitism at colleges, a problem that received renewed attention during campus protests over Israel's war in Gaza that some Jewish students said made them feel unsafe. President Trump returned to the White House with the goal of rooting out anti-Semitism that he said had gone unchecked during the Biden administration, but critics have called his government's response heavy-handed and said it infringed on free speech rights and coerced concessions from public institutions. Lawyers for the former Justice Department attorney, identified as Haley Van Arum, filed the disclosure Tuesday with Inspectors General at the Departments of Justice and Health and Human Services and the Office of Special Counsel. Van Arum spent nearly a decade working in the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division before being assigned to help with the task force last year. She left the Justice Department in May 2025 because she was unwilling to be made vulnerable to further participation in politically motivated investigations unsupported by facts and contrary to law, according to the complaint, which also accuses the task force of having targeted Muslim professors. Spokespeople for the Justice Department and Health and Human Services Department did not immediately respond to requests seeking comment Tuesday. Representative Jamie Raskin, the top Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee, wrote separately to Harmeet Dhillon, who, as the Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division, has been a public face of the department's efforts to counter anti-Semitism. In his letter, He said anti-Semitism at colleges and medical schools is a real problem that needs to be investigated. But, he told Dylan, your investigation, in quotes, into anti-Semitism was fake, a pre-baked frame-up operation, thoroughly political in nature. Raskin wrote that the whole project was designed to harass professors and administrators at major universities, to curtail their freedom of speech and academic freedom, and to strip targeted institutions of hundreds of millions of dollars in grants that they had already been awarded on the merits of their applications. The whistleblower complaint deals chiefly with investigations into three Ivy League universities, Brown, Harvard, and Columbia. It alleges that in the case of Brown, the investigative team did not find evidence to support a violation of Title VI, the section of the Civil Rights Act that bars discrimination on the basis of race, color, or national origin in programs that receive federal funding, but that leadership refused to permit a notice of no violation and instead sought some form of settlement or resolution despite acknowledging the absence of a legal basis for doing so. Investigators did find evidence of discrimination at Columbia, the complaint says, but the investigation was done on an accelerated timetable before adequate factual development and legal review were completed, and relied on allegations that were unsupported, based on news reports or litigation filings, or that implicated a protected First Amendment activity. Columbia University agreed to pay the government $200 million as part of an agreement restoring access to federal funding. Brown University separately agreed to pay $50 million to Rhode Island workforce development organizations to end the three federal investigations involving allegations of anti-Semitism and racial bias in admissions with no findings of wrongdoing. In the investigation into Harvard, Trump administration officials discussed extraordinary funding freezes and sweeping proposed settlement terms before an investigation had been completed that could establish Title VI violations. Sean Cavaney, then HHS acting general counsel, said he believed Harvard would settle because they were over a barrel, according to the complaint. A federal judge last year ordered the Trump administration to reverse its cuts of more than $2.6 billion in research funding for the university, saying the government used anti-Semitism as a smokescreen for a targeted, ideologically motivated assault on this country's premier universities. Pamela?
Democratic Socialist wins Florida primary. State Representative Angie Nixon of Jacksonville, a progressive firebrand who ran a long-shot campaign, won the Democratic nomination for Senate in Florida, according to the Associated Press, the latest left-wing victory against establishment Democrats. In a sizable upset, Nixon, 42, defeated Alex Vindman, a former national security official who was a top witness in President Trump's first impeachment trial. His entry was largely welcomed by Democratic Party leaders hoping to make Florida, which leans right, at least competitive this fall. Vindman far outraised Nixon and was the clear front-runner in the race. But there was no public polling before the primary. Pollsters most likely saw little upside to spending money in a state that Trump won by 13 percentage points in 2024. Nixon, a union organizer, ran a grassroots campaign, often driving herself to events across the state, clad in her signature hot pink outfits, and relying on volunteers and union members for field organizing. In a low turnout primary, they bet that reaching enough Democratic voters directly and talking to them about issues such as unaffordable health care and child care would drive them to the polls to support Nixon. The strategy succeeded. Nixon defeated Vindman across Florida's urban counties, including in Miami-Dade and Broward, where Vindman lived. Nixon rolled to victory despite an enormous fundraising disparity. She raised about $975,000 during the campaign, while Vindman, powered by National Donor Network, raised $16.3 million. Vin was so confident in winning Tuesday that they had a fundraiser scheduled for Sunday in Nantucket as he prepared for a costly general election. Nixon, who joined the Democratic Socialists of America in June, will now test whether a progressive can win over moderate Democrats, as well as independents and crossover Republicans in an increasingly red state. She will challenge Senator Ashley Moody, the Republican incumbent, in November. Although Moody is a sitting senator, Democrats see her as potentially vulnerable in a tough midterm year for Republicans. She has held the position only since last year, having been appointed by Governor Ron DeSantis, a Republican, after Marco Rubio left the post to become Secretary of State. She remains little known among Florida voters, polls show. In other key Florida races, Representative Byron Donalds won the Republican nomination for Florida governor, and former Representative David Jolly picked up the Democratic nod, setting the stage for a fall campaign to replace DeSantis, who faces term limits. Donalds will be Florida's first black governor if he wins in November. He defeated a former DeSantis running mate, Lieutenant Governor Jay Collins, political newcomer James Fishback, and others Tuesday. Donalds has promised to push tax cuts, overhaul insurance regulations to lower costs, and seek greater transparency in health care. The Democrats' candidate, Jolly, is a former Republican congressman who switched parties last year. "To my Democratic friends, thank you for welcoming me into the party," he said. Jolly's speech details a platform that balances between both political parties, an embrace of capitalism and a lean government, but one that needs to do its part to fill the gaps, such as with education and housing. The biggest contest for U.S. House saw longtime Democratic Representative Debbie Wasserman Schultz defeat former Representative Sheila Terfelis McCormick and others in a redrawn South Florida district. Wasserman Schultz, who is white, urged voters in the new plurality black district to help her return to Washington for a 12th term. Terfelis McCormick has sought a comeback after resigning this year under a pending federal indictment and threats of ethics sanctions. Wasserman Schultz entered a new district after DeSantis' successful push for new congressional maps intended to boost GOP midterm prospects. Elections were also held in Wyoming, Alaska, and California. Karen?
Thanks, Pamela. Also in national news, frequent flyers face high cancer risks. Flight attendants, pilots affected by greater radiation. And this story is from the Associated Press out of New York. Flight attendants and pilots are at the highest risk of dying from radiation-related cancers, even more than people who work with radioactive materials, according to a new study. Cosmic radiation comes from space. Only a small amount reaches the Earth's surface, but exposure is greater for people flying at high altitudes. There's been limited evidence from small studies suggesting the exposure translates to higher cancer death rates among people who fly often, particularly pilots and flight attendants. The new study brings important new evidence to bear on this question. Two Australian radiation experts who weren't involved in the research wrote in an accompanying commentary. The latest study, published Monday by JAMA Internal Medicine, used national data from more than 12 million death certificates that included information about occupations. The authors looked at death rates from cancers that are tied to radiation exposures, including leukemia, lymphoma, multiple myeloma, and cancers of the skin, breast, thyroid, prostate, and central nervous system. Among more than 500 occupations, flight attendants had the highest percentage of deaths from radiation-related cancers, and pilots were second, the researchers found. For those two occupations, the odds of dying were unusually high for each type of radiation-related cancer. Neither group showed higher than normal death rates from cancers that aren't tied to radiation exposure, noted the commentary writers, Catherine Olson and Ken Karapetis. That fact supports the hypothesis that occupational radiation exposure, rather than lifestyle or socioeconomic factors, underlies the observed excess, they wrote. The researchers found that flight attendants had about 50% higher odds of dying from a radiation-related cancer than the general working population, and pilots had about 36% higher odds. In terms of absolute risk, about 6.9% of flight attendant deaths were from these cancers, roughly 1 in 14. Among pilots, it was 6.7%. For the general working population, it was 5%, said the study's first author, Dr. Vishal Patel of Harvard Medical School. The authors acknowledged some limitations in their study. They do not know how much exposure each flight attendant and pilot got in the air, or from other sources. It's also possible occupations were misclassified on some death certificates. The Federal Aviation Administration has acknowledged that air crews are exposed to ionizing radiation, but the government does not set federal dose limits or require monitoring, the authors noted. Sarah Nelson, who leads a union representing 55,000 flight attendants, said the report reinforces that radiation exposure needs to be taken seriously, as the union has suggested for years. The risk is known, but crew are not educated or informed, and no one is taking responsibility, said Nelson. Annual skin examinations may be warranted for all people working on high-altitude flights, and women in those jobs may want to get mammograms earlier or more frequently, Olson and Karapetis wrote. Doctors who care for pilots and flight attendants also should have a heightened index of suspicion for cancer when evaluating these patients, they said. Pamela?
Thanks, Karen. Are they dancing or fighting? Capoeira brings Afro-Brazilian martial arts to Cambridge Common. A woman's foot swept through the clear summer air at Cambridge Common as she tried to kick her opponent in the face on a recent evening. Her adversary, another woman, ducked and narrowly avoided getting hit. Nearby, a man flipped onto their hands before springing back to his feet. Others in their group clapped and sang. It was hard to tell whether they were fighting or dancing. The answer? They were doing both. The group was practicing capoeira, an Afro-Brazilian martial art that blends combat with dance, acrobatics, and music. For me, the biggest thing that capoeira gave me was the belief in myself. Jay LaCouture, 44, an instructor at Capoeira Brazil, a martial arts school specializing in capoeira that hosts outdoor summer classes at Cambridge Common. Anytime that I can give someone a little piece of that belief in themselves, that is power. Capoeiras, as these athletes are called, use kicks, dodges, spins, and flips in a rhythmic exchange, accompanied by traditional instruments such as the berimbau, a musical bow, and the tambourine. LaCouture, who prefers to go by his capoeira name Camarão, Portuguese for shrimp, said capoeira gives people a better balance and helps them improve how their bodies function overall. But the movement and equilibrium were only part of what Camarão taught. Beneath the music and acrobatics is a history rooted in the experience of enslaved Africans and their descendants in Brazil. During the mid-1500s, Portugal was transporting enslaved Africans to Brazil to work on newly established sugar plantations. The trade continued for nearly two centuries, with Brazil receiving almost 5 million enslaved Africans between 1501 and 1866, including after independence from Portugal in 1822. The origins of capoeira are debated, with three main theories. It was brought to Brazil from Africa by enslaved people, developed in Brazil by enslaved Africans, or originated among indigenous peoples. Those who practiced it could remain physically active for potential escapes and conflicts by disguising its martial elements as music, dance, and ritual, according to Obada Capoeira, San Francisco. Back in slavery times, they would use it as self-defense, said Justin Gagnon, 21, who was there for his first capoeira class in a decade. Nowadays, it's more of a heritage to the culture and expression of that shared life experience that's been built over time. The history remains present in capoeira's music. One of the songs performed during the class included the line, Me leva pra Angola, quem quero voltar. Take me to Angola, I want to go back. Grupo Capoeira Brasil was founded in 1989 in Rio de Janeiro by three masters, including Mestre Boneco, who trained Camarero. The group came to Boston in 2003, the same year Camarero earned his first rank, he said. On Wednesday evening, the class moved through warm-ups and exercises designed to build balance and coordination before turning to ginga, the fundamental movement of capoeira, where students shifted their weight from side to side in a rhythmic, almost dance-like motion. From there, they paired up. One practiced kicks, while others learned to evade and defend. Today, capoeira is practiced worldwide, including by members of Grupo Capoeira Brasil, the organization behind the Cambridge class. For Camarão, the practice has become a decades-long commitment. He has studied capoeira for 26 years, but said he's still only a teacher and not having reached the master's level. We take so long to become these leaders because we want to make sure that we're protecting the brand and how the world sees capoeira, Camarão said. For students, the appeal of it varies. Benedetta Zuccarelli, 28, originally from Italy and now living in Cambridge, came to the class because of her boyfriend, Pietro Bach de Prever. I was always seeing him on the beach or in the house trying his movements, and tonight he finally managed to convince me to try, Zuccarelli said. It took Zuccarelli a year to agree to attend her first class. Her advice to anyone considering trying it was simple. Just try it. Brock de Prever, 28, also originally from Italy, has practiced capoeira for 2 years. He first became interested after watching Pictures of Ghosts, a well-known Brazilian documentary by filmmaker Kleber Mendonça Filho. I was like, are they dancing or fighting, he said. I really like fighting sports where you have to really put a lot of effort in, but then you feel really satisfied. Gagnon, 21, drove an hour from Worcester for his first class. He had taken capoeira lessons when he was 10 and lived in Brazil, but stopped after suffering an injury. A decade later, he decided to return. Capoeira, Gagnon said, shows how to feel every single inch of your body and be mindful about it. He plans to continue attending. The atmosphere is uplifting, Gagnon said. Everyone here is trying to better themselves. For Camarillo, that belief in oneself is ultimately what makes capoeira lessons so powerful. For me, the biggest thing that capoeira gave me was belief in myself, Camarillo said. Any time that I can give someone a little piece of that belief in themselves, that is power.
It certainly is. And our next article is a commentary written by Globe columnist Kevin Cullen. A privilege and burden. Brother of Bill, the politician, and Whitey, the gangster, his life was shaped by both. Jack Bulger will be waked this week at O'Brien's on Dorchester Street about a driver, a three-wood, and pitching wedge from the housing development in South Boston where he grew up. He died last week at the age of 88. He lived and died in the shadow of his older brothers, who were larger than life. He was the baby brother of Bill, the politician, and Whitey, the gangster, and his life was inexorably tied to and shaped by both of them, for both good and bad. Bill helped him land a good job with a good pension. Whitey cost him that pension, enlisting him in a harebrained scheme to help Whitey stay out of prison after Whitey went on the lam in 1994. In 1938, Jack was a newborn when his family moved into the Old Harbor development at 41 Logan Way, just around the corner from St. Monica's Church. He will, as his family noted in his obituary, be remembered for his generosity, humor, and fierce loyalty. If that last quality defined him, it also helped and cost him in equal measure. In 1964, Jack accompanied their father, James, for whom Whitey was named, to visit Whitey after he was transferred to the federal prison in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. It was the last time the elder Bulger would see his wayward son. Bill Bulger said his father never had a good day after Whitey went to prison. James Bulger did not live long enough to see his son emerge from prison and become the city's most powerful and lethal gangster. Bill Bulger became a powerful figure himself on Beacon Hill, ascending to Senate president in 1978. With his politician brother's considerable influence, Jack became clerk magistrate of the Boston Juvenile Court in 1982, a job that he held until his retirement in 2001. But even as an officer of the court, Jack Bulger didn't hesitate to help his gangster brother after Whitey went on the lam in 1994. He paid the monthly rental fee for a safe deposit box Whitey kept at a bank in Clearwater, Florida, and he spoke with Whitey twice in prearranged telephone calls while Whitey was on the run. Jack Bulger lied twice before federal grand juries investigating Whitey, insisting he hadn't spoken to his fugitive brother since Whitey took off, and that he didn't know where he hid his money. During one of those phone calls, Jack agreed to help Whitey obtain phony IDs to use on the run. Even though Jack was 9 years younger than Whitey, they bore enough of a resemblance to make the scheme somewhat plausible. Whitey instructed Kevin Weeks, his top lieutenant, to go to Jack's home in Southie to take photos with Jack wearing a fake mustache. When Weeks delivered the fake ID to Whitey at the Water Tower in Chicago, Whitey frowned. The photo was all wrong. Whitey's mustache was pencil thin. Jack's was big and bushy. It looked like he had a caterpillar on his lip. The task force trying to find Whitey put traces on the phones of Bill and Jack, but a corrupt state cop told Whitey's partner in crime, Stevie Flemmy, about it. Flemmy, whose parents were Bill Bulger's neighbors, gave them the heads up. What the cops couldn't do, Whitey did unwittingly, using traceable phone cards to call his brothers, which put them in compromising positions. In a letter to a friend after he was captured in 2011, Whitey acknowledged he screwed up. "I put the heat on people," he admitted. "My brother Jack was trapped." After it emerged that he had admitted to a grand jury that he had spoken to his brother while Whitey was on the run, Bill was forced to resign as president of the University of Massachusetts, the sweet sinecure he had secured after his tenure as Senate president. But Bill was able to keep his annual $274,539 pension. Jack wasn't as lucky. In 2003, Jack was sentenced to 6 months in prison and 6 months of house arrest for lying to two grand juries and thwarting efforts to capture his brother. He was stripped of his pension, which was not even a quarter of Bill's. Loyalty to Whitey had cost Jack his freedom and his income, and it cost Bill his job and, in the eyes of many, his good name. It was a heavy price to pay for the Bulger credo of family above all else. While Whitey was willing to forgive Teresa Stanley, his longtime companion, who spoke to the authorities after deciding she didn't want to spend her life on the lam with him, Jack was less forgiving. During an interview for the book Shelley Murphy and I wrote about Whitey, Stanley told us that Jack Bulger confronted her once while walking on Castle Island and snarled, "I wish you were dead. Look at what you've done, all the trouble you caused." Well, that was pretty rich because Teresa Stanley didn't cause any trouble. Whitey did. That was something that neither Jack nor Bill were able to fully acknowledge. They remembered the funny, fiercely loyal, and protective brother who stuck up for little kids and carried the groceries for older neighbors. But it was Whitey who murdered people. It was Whitey who made millions by allowing drug dealers to operate freely in Southie as long as they paid him tribute, while his family perpetuated the myth that Whitey was the Robin Hood of Southie, that he kept the drugs out of Southie. It was Whitey who made their lives difficult, not the state police and DEA agents who finally held Whitey to account, not the reporters who wrote about his exploits, not the big bad world outside of Southie. They were enthusiastic purveyors of Southie exceptionalism, the myth that Southie was God's country, the best neighborhood in the city, while Whitey's criminal activity rotted the neighborhood from within, like termites. When Whitey was convicted of murder and myriad crimes in the courthouse on the waterfront, named for his old neighbor, Joe Moakley, he gave a thumbs up to Jack as he was led out of the courtroom. Whatever you think of them, the Bulger brothers had longevity in their genes. Whitey was 89 when he was murdered in a West Virginia prison in 2018. Jack made it to 88. Bill is, at 92, the last one standing. The Bulger brothers lived long, long lives, a blessing not afforded to so many of Whitey's victims. Pamela?
Thanks, Karen. And the answer to Art Museum's crisis is AI. Art museums have a perception crisis on their hands. They're seen as stuffy and hallowed, less than exciting field trip destinations, and the kinds of places where you need expensive art degrees to understand what's going on. Harvard Art Museums want to put a dent in that perception. Last year, they launched a digital marketing campaign that brought an 18th century painting to life. How? They used a deep fake. Using generative AI, the museums made an 18th century French painting into a talking avatar. It was meant as good fun that might appeal to broader audiences, but it also caused a stir. And it wasn't the first time a museum's use of AI has raised eyebrows, including when the Museum of Fine Arts put a Chaim hot dog in a portrait of Ben Franklin. In an age of intense discourse around AI, particularly when it comes to art, experts and the public are debating how it should be used and when it's acceptable and not. Harvard Art Museum's campaign became a polarizing case study for Harvard Business School and then was adapted into an episode for Cold Call, Harvard Business Review's in-house podcast. Officials in the marketing department at Harvard Art Museum said they saw AI as an opportunity to reach untapped markets. Generative AI was used, yes, they said, but as a promotional tool to bring people in. No original works were actually physically retouched, and no artwork was taken from artists. "We weren't using AI to replace an artwork or any scholarship around it," said John Connolly, the marketing director of Harvard Art Museums. "We were using it, really, as an invitation." The modern museum visitor, he said, does not move through museums in a linear way anymore. "Museums are so filled with stories," he said. "As a marketing person, it's our responsibility to try to get those stories out without overwhelming a potential visitor." He said his team thought it was worth looking at AI and seeing what they could do. Her name was Madame de Pompadour, and this 18th century painting became the star of last year's divisive campaign. She was sent straight into the inboxes of the museum's mailing list. Recipients could have a conversation with her and learn about her and the painting itself. "We think the AI can make artworks more interesting and be more attractive and bring people back to visit the museum," said Jeff Liu, who founded Acool, the California-based AI company that supplied de Pompadour's technological makeover. Art historians in the museum were concerned. "If someone with zero art experience is told how to interpret the art and is essentially given that interpretation automatically, are they really interacting with the piece?" What's interesting about that debate is the chat box can unlock so much more creativity and also accessibility on the part of the user, said Julian De Freitas, associate professor of business administration and AI researcher at Harvard. "Imagine someone who has no education in art. They might actually be able to engage the artwork at whatever level they're coming in with." De Freitas summarized their concern. "You're turning this one into a narrow interpretation, and you're not really stimulating people to think for themselves." His view, there are new benefits that come from making art interactive. Museums, he said, can feel stuffy, quiet, and inaccessible. Incorporating tech can potentially downplay those public feelings. He hopes a potential museum visitor will think, "Hey, I can actually just talk to this artwork, and it's not this scary thing that I need to approach only after I have, like, 3 years of art education." De Freitas acknowledged the concern that AI could lead us to lose our skills. "Yes, Madame de Pompadour was a chatbox," he said, "but that doesn't necessarily mean she's taking away anyone's skills unless they were truly speaking to her in a mindless fashion. It's just part of a campaign, so it's not like replacing the original," he said. In June, the MFA sparked citywide debate after its involvement in a July 4th campaign that used AI to insert KM hot dogs into three of its paintings. The MFA declined to comment, but the integrated marketing director of KM said the campaign was really intended to be super tongue-in-cheek. "AI came in to help just think about, like, how do we insert it," said Gary Mack. "Ultimately, the illustrators, the designers, they're the ones that fully integrated it, created final works of art, created all the assets you see online and in the campaign." Arne Cassavant, a landscape painter based at a gallery in Boston, said any publicity is good publicity, but that it's a changing world. "Over the past 20 years, we saw a turn in the direction of fewer people coming in," he said. "I think maybe it's 2% of the population that buys original art." Cassavant has come to realization that his son's generation can go online and buy a 24x36 image of two trees for the slot above his couch, he said, and never step foot in a gallery. AI is evolutionary. The thing is, it's happening so quickly that it's difficult to embrace, but we have to. Otherwise, we'll be left behind. "I'll be painting in my cellar that I'm now without an audience," he said. "If AI can be used to capture that whole new audience, they want that. They love that. They live that." Steve Bennett, a visual artist based in Cambridge, said he understands why museums are using AI, but wonders if it will make art a spectacle. He said visitors may be dazzled by a museum's promotional material and then be disappointed by the still painting on the wall. Bennett's walk is not in the museum, but he says he's not opposed to an institution using AI to promote his work, if given the opportunity. It would depend on how it's used, but in general, he said he would say yes. "Museums need visitors, especially now," he said. "They need to be considered relevant, and they need to generate revenue. It seems that AI can help deliver all these." Karen?
Interesting. Child badly hurt by falling tree limb at camp. A boy suffered life-threatening injuries when a large tree branch fell on him at a summer day camp in Wayland Tuesday morning, and a camp counselor struck by a smaller branch was also hurt, officials said. Emergency crews responded to the incident at YMCA Camp Chickamee around 10:40 a.m., where they found the child with critical injuries, Wayland Fire Chief Neil McPherson said at a press conference Tuesday afternoon. The boy, whose age has not been disclosed, was initially taken to Wayland Town Hall and was flown from there by medical helicopter to Massachusetts General Hospital, McPherson said. The camp counselor was hospitalized with minor injuries, he added. We just want to extend our thoughts and well wishes to the family of that child, and certainly to the first responders, McPherson said. Calls like this, when you're dealing with children, are exceptionally difficult, and today's case was certainly very difficult for all the responders. Children were in an open area in the woods when a large tree fell, taking down another tree, said Wayland Acting Police Chief Mark Hebert. It was kind of a domino effect that set off the whole thing. We would both agree this is something highly unusual, but it's a wooded area, McPherson said. Sometimes natural events happen that we don't expect. The incident is under investigation. And that's all the time we have left for today's reading of the Boston Globe. This is Karen.
And Pamela.
Thanking all of you so much for joining us today and asking you to please stay tuned for today's reading of the Boston Herald.